Marlowe. He's one of our Fulbright Fellows. It's been a pleasure to have him over the course of the week, and they've all been doing a great job, really learning hard and working hard and doing a lot of things at once, and they've been getting through the week in the most successful manner. This is Yehuda Dobries, and it's a pleasure to welcome you guys to our community and introduce them for this year.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to first, of course, say thank you to our host for having us. And I also want to say thank you to everyone who's here. I know it's not an easy thing to come out at 8 p.m. for share and to be ready to learn and listen and think. And so I just want to say thank you for coming out. It's really important. It shows how much you care and how much Torah is important to you, your lives, and to your community. So I want to just say yashar koach and thank you to everyone for coming. So tonight's topic, theological approaches to anti-Semitism, really came to me this past summer. This past summer, I was the assistant director of an NCSY program for public school teams. And as I was interviewing teens for the program, a common theme that I noticed was that a lot of students were experiencing and encountering anti-Semitism in their schools. And I was, first I tried to ask them, how are you guys dealing with anti-Semitism? How are you combating it? And some of them had, unfortunately, really bad answers. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know who to go to for guidance. And some kids actually were incredibly proactive and were speaking to administrators, speaking to teachers, principals. I even had one student who was teaching the entire faculty of the school about diversity and sensitivity to anti-Semitism. That was really special. She's a very, very special teenager. And so it got me thinking, okay, I have 4 weeks with these teens in Israel. How are we going to talk about anti-Semitism? So that's kind of number one. Number two is, what does Jewish tradition, what do the Chachmei HaMesorah, our heirs, our intellectual, progenitors, what do they have to share with us? What knowledge, information do they have to share with us about anti-Semitism? So I kind of went into the sources and wanted to see, what do Chazal say? What do the rabbis say about anti-Semitism? So what we're going to do is we're going to go through a few different rabbinic texts about anti-Semitism or different approaches to anti-Semitism, and hopefully learn a little bit about what Chazal thought about anti-Semitism, and then perhaps go a little bit further, thinking more about what anti-Semitism looks like nowadays and perhaps how to combat it. So the locus classicus, the classic text about anti-Semitism, comes from the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, the first source. So the Gemara tells a story. Amar lehahu mirabanan l'Rav Kahana, one of the scholars, one of the rabbis, said to Rav Kahana, Mishmi alecha mai har Sinai, have you heard what the etymology, what the origin of the term har Sinai is? So Amar leh, Rav Kahana responds to the fellow, and he says, Har Shanasu bo nisim li Yisrael. It is a mountain on which miracles occur to the Jewish people. To which this young rabbinic scholar responds to him, Har Nisayim Yibayilei. If that was the case, really the mountain's name should be Nisayi, which relates to the word Nes, the word miracle. El Har Shanasa Siman Tov li Yisrael. Okay, Rav Kahana takes a step back. He says, okay, I know that was the first answer I gave you, but let's try again. He says, really, it's a mountain that a positive omen. Good things happen to the Jewish people. To which this young scholar wittily responds, Har Simani mi ba'ilei. No, it should have said Har Simani, the mountain of Simani. So Amar Lei, so Rav Kahana says to him on his third attempt, My time lo shachita kamei derev papa v'rafuna b'rei derev Yoshua. Why haven't you been before Rav Papa and Rav Huna, the son of Rabbi Yoshua, Demayne Bagadata, who were those who looked into the study of Agadata, of more creative rabbinic interpretation? Why? De Amrit Trevayhu, because they both say, My Har Sinai, what is the etymology of the phrase Har Sinai? Har Shiyarda Sina Le'umo Ta'ulam Alaf. It is the mountain of which hatred from the nations of the world toward the Jewish people descended. Reactions.
Well, my reaction is it sounds the same, but it's not spelt the same. Sinai and Sinai are from Shit with Sin and Samach. So I mean, you could, if you're doing all these other things about, like, it's not this because it should have been NACE, and it's not this because it should have been, yeah, so then why this if it's not really spelled the same way?
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, and it's kind of funny. Like, we have, like, two responses, and then we have a third one, which is like the, I guess, like, the wisecraft response, which is, like, haven't you learned, like, this is obviously what the answer is, and then we get a similar answer. Yeah, that's a really great point.
It's also really negative.
Yeah.
The place where we got the Torah, like, we were born as a nation, and it's about hatred of us.
Yeah.
It distinguished us completely from the rest of the world. At a time when the rest of the world had completely different attitudes and beliefs, we learned something completely different now. Why wouldn't they hate us? You know, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me.
So, if you look at, not to use Mein Kampf as a harah or a makor, but, you know, you look at the two things that are mentioned here, that they, why they hate the Jews, as he mentions Bris Milah, because they brought Bris Milah into the world, and they brought morality into the world. So Har Sinai represents the Matan Torah, which is the mitzvah saseh, and the morality that goes along with the kiyum of mitzvahs. So it's the act of bringing Torah into the world that is what generates people's hatred of us.
Yeah, that's incredible. And what both of you are saying is what the general trend throughout the rabbinic sources tends to follow in terms of the idea of the Jews having something that leads to jealousy, something positive, something that perhaps the non-Jews are apprehensive to.
But even more basic is the fact that the Jews introduced monotheism to the world. This was the first time all the other cultures believed in multiple gods. So this was their major contribution, aside from the verse, et cetera, but monotheism.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that you say that, because virtually none of the commenters relate to that. They mostly respond to the different, you know, like, more halachic mitzvot types of things. So that's, like, a really, like, it's a, that's a, that's, that's a great observation. That really, this, it's even more fundamental than the Torah and the mitzvot. It's that there's one God.
Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I think, does anybody else have any first impressions? I was the first time I saw this, I was like, whoa, this is really. This is so fascinating. And, like, another reason why I thought it was so interesting is because I think that this idea that there's some sort of hatred for non-Jews is this idea that transcends generations, that transcends Jewish communities and societies, and is something that we've been carrying with us for a long time. It happens to be, this past week, I was in Israel with APAC as part of a rabbinic fellowship, where they take rabbinical students of different denominations, they bring them to Israel, and they teach them about Israel and what's going on. We met with politicians and political thinkers. And one of the really interesting speakers that they brought us to is Dr. Tal Becker, who is a scholar at the Shalom Hartman Institute, but also, and I think more impressively so, is the head negotiator for the State of Israel with the Palestinian Authority. So he was talking to us about a whole bunch of ideas. And one thing that was really interesting that he shared with us is that there's kind of this tension between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that we have these conflicting stories and narratives that are, like, really mutually exclusive that we won't move on. So I don't want to get too much into that, into those politics, but what he said about the Jewish people and about the Israelis is that we have, as a, not just as a society, but as a nation through the generations, we've had this mentality of, even if we make peace with the non-Jews, their hatred is going to come from another place. Kind of like the opposite of Esther, where Mordechai says to her, you know, if you don't take this opportunity, like, Hatzalah, you know, salvation will come from somewhere else. It's kind of like the opposite mentality of, like, even if we make peace with the Palestinians, there will still be hatred that comes, from another source. And this really struck me because I think, yeah.
I have a question. Just looking at the last phrase, the translation also seems to make it sound like we hate the other nations rather than they hate us. So which way do we read this?
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating point. A lot of commentators try to deal with the imprecise language of Olav, which makes it seem like the hatred is the Jewish hatred toward the non-Jews. In the larger framework of the Gemara, it seems that from a literary perspective, all of the different conversations, which I didn't bring here, but they continue later on, don't follow this trend that this word alav would refer to the umot ha'olam. It means that it's referring to the object, so it would be Har Sinai. But I think that's also like something interesting, which is that maybe there is this component of Jewish hatred toward non-Jews that might be part of Harsinai, which also I think expresses itself sometimes in different Jewish communities or the more radicalized extreme sides of the Jewish community that believes in some sort of racial superiority, which I think is interesting. I don't think it's the most logical interpretation, but I definitely think it is, and I think that adds to this conversation about what's the nature of this hatred. Yeah, it's a great point.
But our religion is one of the few religions in practice that doesn't go out to seek converts through force. We don't do that. Whereas every other religion, I mean, the Bible is one of everyone to convert to Islam. Okay, that's basic to their religion, by the way, and certainly Christianity did its job on the Jews as well. But we did not go out and actively and forcibly have converts, and that's a big difference.
Yeah, I think it's great, and I think we're gonna get back to that, revisit that point momentarily. So just hold on to that thought. So kind of just to kind of like just like tie up a loose end here. So something that struck out to me is, so I was a psychology major in college. I'm also planning on pursuing some graduate level psychology education. And I really connected a lot to the work of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, who really are the two main psychologists of the 19th and 20th century, who bring the unconscious to the masses, and the idea that there is this thing called the unconscious. Now, Freud was a little bit crazy in some, you know, some arenas, and we, you know, a lot of modern psychoanalytic theory has rejected that. But the ideas that Freud has brought and that Jung have brought about the unconscious is something that stays with us. So Jung is also a very weird thinker, and he's primarily known for his idea of the collective unconscious, which he borrows from the world of anthropology. That he noticed that there are certain themes and ideas that transcend societies, geography, and historical epochs. And so what he believes is that built into the neurological structure of the brain are these kind of psychological structures that generate these similar ideas across civilizations and across times. Okay, I'm not really sure what to do with that. I think it's really interesting. But I think it's so fascinating that this idea of Har Sinai, of Harsh Yarda Sina Le'umot Olam Alav, that this idea that we've had this idea about hatred throughout Jewish history, and it's intergenerational, to me it seems so reminiscent of this kind of this idea of the collective unconscious, that we as a people, no matter where we are, who we are, what time, our gender, our race, our political views, we all, you know, have this common idea, which I just think is fascinating. I wanted to know, because that was the connection that I made when I first kind of encountered this text. But returning to this idea of Jews not proselytizing, of Jews being happy with what we have and not enforcing it on others. So I think it's interesting that Chazal, that the rabbis in multiple places, and I only brought one text, discuss the idea of God offering the Torah to the other nations, and that Torah isn't in the exclusive domain of the Jewish people, but rather the non-Jews had an opportunity also to have the Torah. So if we look at the third source on the page from the Sifrei, we're going to take a look at what this more famous midrash about God offering the Torah to the other nations. So if we start at the end of the first line, Kishin Nigla Hamakom Litin Torah Yisrael, Lo Al Yisrael Bilvad Hu Nigla. When God decided He wanted to reveal the Torah to the Jewish people, He didn't only reveal it to the Jewish people alone. Al Kol Ha'umot. Rather, He wanted to reveal it. He wanted to give it to all the nations of the world. Betchila Halach Etzel Bnei Esav. Originally, God went to the children, the descendants of Esav, Amar Lehem, and said to them, Mekavlim Atem et Torah? Are you guys interested in the Torah? It's for you, if you want. Amru Lo, to which he responded, which they responded to him, Makatuba, what do you have in the Torah? We're interested to hear this proposition. To which God responds, Amar Lehem Lo Tirzak, it says, don't murder. Not so, you know, a small thing. Amru, so they communally responded, Ribbono Shel Olam, God, Master of the Universe, Kol Atzmo Shel Oto Avihem Roteachu. The entire essence of our progenitor, of our forefather, Esav, was murder. He was all about murder. Shneamar, as the Torah tells us, v'hayadayim v'dei Esav, that the hands were the hands of Esav. This is talking about Yaakov when he was tricking Yitzchak to get the bracha. V'yakach yivtichu avi. Therefore, when Yitzchak later gives Esav a bracha, the bracha that is given is Shneamar alchar v'cha tichya, that you shall live by your sword. In other words, that it's going to be murder. Not such a bracha, which is for another share. But they say, okay, this isn't going to work for us, the B'nai Esav. So then God keeps going. God's walking around town, seeing who else is interested, who's an interested entrepreneur and an interested investor. So he goes to the next nation. Halachlo Itzel B'nai Amon V'Moab V'Amar Lahem Mekabel Matan Torah. So he goes to the descendants of Amon and Moab, and he says to them, do you want the Torah? To which they respond, yeah, we're pretty open-minded. Amar Lo Makatuvba, what do you got in there? Amar Lahem Lo Tinaf, don't commit adultery. Amar Lefanav. So they say to him, Ribono Shel Olam, God, come on. Atzma Shel Erva Lehem Yi. What do you mean? Adultery, unrestrained sexual ethic is the pillar of our forefathers, Shneamar. V'tahareen Shtei Benot Lot Me'aviyahem. That the Torah tells us about how Lot had the children of his daughters after the destruction of Sodom. Okay, so they're not interested in either. So God goes, Halaf b'matzav b'nei Yishmael, and God goes to the descendants of Yishmael, Amar lahem, and he says to them, Akal b'matzav b'nei Torah, would you like the Torah? Amar lo makatuv ba, right? The same thing. What's written in the Torah? Amar lahem, lo tignov, don't steal, not so bad. Amar lefana, they say in front of him, Ribono shel Olam, master of the universe, kol atzma avihem listim haya, our forefathers, all they cared about was thievery. Shneamar b'hu yeh per adam, the Esav would be a beast, a wild man, beast of a man. So the narrative of the Midrash tells us there was not one nation of the world that God didn't walk around, that God didn't offer proposition the Torah to. He knocked on all of the doors and he said, would you like to accept the Torah? All the kings of the land will admit to you, kishamu imrificha, that they've heard the words from your mouth, that they've heard your Torah. So the Midrash ends, yechol shamu b'kiblu. Is it possible that the non-Jewish nations heard God's Torah and they accepted it? Talmud Lomar, the pasuk from Yecheskel tells us, ve'atem lo ta'asu, and your nations, the non-Jewish nations, are not going to do it from the Torah. You're not going to follow the Torah. Ve'omer, and then later the Torah tells us in Micha, ve'asiti ba'af b'chema, nakam et agoy asher lo shamu. And I, with anger and wrath, I will take revenge upon the nations of the world because they did not accept the mitzvah. In other words, the non-Jews didn't keep the mitzvah.
Basic question. Where do we find the source for God appearing to all these other nations? What is the source for this? It sounds astounding that if God appeared to someone at that time, that there would be an astounding happening. I mean, today, with TV and everything else, nothing. But then, this would be phenomenal. So what is the source for this information?
I think this is this is inspired by the rabbis and the way that they're understanding the Torah and the narratives of the Torah. I think what you're highlighting is like there is a certain hyperbole, exaggeration in terms of then God literally comes to them and it's God and they say, yeah, well, what's in it for me? It's a little strong. Oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot to put a source on the sheet that I kind of wanted to use to take this idea further. That the Jewish people, not only does the hate come from the Jewish people, the hate comes to the Jewish people because God chose us because of our special election by God, and that God tried to offer it to the non-Jews. But the Drasha Haran, the Ran, goes even further. So it's really interesting. This is what the Ran says. Just grab it from my phone. Okay. So the Ran says, the Ran quotes this Gemara. He says, he quotes this Gemara about my Har Sinai, Har Sheyarda Sina Li'umot Ha'olam Alav, that it's the mountain upon which hatred came
to the Jewish people. V'kemo shamru, as it says in Shir HaShirim, im timsu et dodi, ma tagidulo shecholat ahava ani, that we have in Shir HaShirim, that the beloved says to the Benot Yerushalayim, my beloved came and I missed my beloved, and if you see him, tell him how lovesick I am. So the Ran understands this. He says, higidulo shekol chalaim shumot ha'olam meviot alai, all of the maladies, all of the hardships that come from the nations of the world upon me, Israel, einam ela bishvil shani ohevet oto. It's because I, Israel, love God. That's where this comes from, that this hatred comes from our love of God. And he goes even further and he says, v'hatam bazev, the reason for this hatred is mipnei shehiv dilanu Hashem min ha'umot, that God separated us from the non-Jews. Shalom nitchaten bam, that you won't marry non-Jews, you won't assimilate. And that you'll keep kosher, you'll have a certain social ethic which will separate you from the non-Jews. And this difference between you and the non-Jews is naturally leading to sina, to hatred. So I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that morality in Bris Milah as the reasons why the non-Jews would be apprehensive to the Jewish people and to the Jewish faith, because the Ran says that the two things are assimilation and kashrut, which kashrut's a chok, and assimilation is just the first step to maintaining your Jewish identity. So I think it's really interesting that's the way that you understood it, because that's what I would have thought. That's what makes us different. Yeah.
It's very interesting because the thing about anti-Semitism being totally irrational, because no matter what we do, right? So they'll say, well, because we keep ourselves separate, or because we assimilate, we don't belong. Or because we're wealthy, or because we're poor, or because we have a certain political position, or we have the other, it doesn't really make much of a difference. So it's interesting that comes out as one thing in terms of our keeping ourselves separate, but we didn't do that well with assimilation either. I mean, mm-hmm. like Germany and so on, where we did assimilate, and it still struck us.
Right. And I think that brings us, if we turn to the next page, to the second approach. So if we say that this first theological approach to anti-Semitism is anti-Semitism is because we are different, which is, I think, xenophobia, fear of the other, as represented by any other fear of the other in any other society. But I think that the next approach, the approach of Nitziv, has a little bit of a different take about anti-Semitism. So the Nitziv actually has a fascinating essay, I think at the end of his commentary on Shir HaShirim, that delves into the question of anti-Semitism. But instead I brought, instead of bringing you an entire essay, I brought you one snippet of his commentary on the Haggadah, and his Haggadah called the Imre Shefer. And in the Haggadah, he's commenting on the phrase, V'hisha amda labutinu lanu, that in every generation, the non-Jews arise and try to destroy the people, and it is God that saves us. I think this context is really key because it's fascinating how the Nitziv interprets this, because it's kind of the opposite of that phrase. So let's start from the beginning. So Shiratun HaKadosh Baruch, this is what the Nitziv says, that it's God's will, Hayash Zera Abraham Yu Geirim Davka Be'eretz Lahem, that the descendants and the children of Abraham Avinu would be foreigners, specifically foreigners, the aliens, in a land that is not theirs. That's what the Torah tells us in Bereishit. The Kfisha Amar Yaakov Paro, just as Yaakov said to Paro when Yosef sends for Yaakov, the whole family, to come back to Mitzrayim. So just as Yaakov says to Paro, Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, we merely came to sojourn in the land. We didn't come to live, to move, to be immigrants. We're here temporarily. We're here for the famine. We're here for the relief. And then we're going back. We're only sojourners. We're only guests in this country. V'eina Kavana, the intention wasn't Sha'ala B'dad Yaakov, that Yaakov was thinking, Shaloli Yisheir b'Mitzrayim el la'alot achar shnei ra'av. Yaakov wasn't thinking about permanently relocating to Mitzrayim, rather he was just staying there for the duration of the famine. V'zeh haya ratzon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This was God's desire, that it would only be temporary. V'haftachto la'Avraham Avinu shiyu geirim. That God's promise to Avraham Avinu was that they would only be geirim, they would only be temporary residents. And then, like Hashem promised to Abraham Avinu, they would return to Eretz Canaan, to Eretz Yisrael, as God promised to Abraham, that the land would be given to the Jewish people, and that's where they would live. And since the Jewish people decided that they wanted to assimilate, since they decided they wanted to acculturate, So what happens to them? Al kein hafach libam lisno amo. Therefore, God changed the emotional state of the non-Jews, of the Egyptians, to hate the Jewish people. That because the Jewish people wanted to assimilate into Egyptian culture, God made it so that the Egyptians were not welcoming of the Jewish people. And he takes this further, and he goes, this wasn't just the door of Mitzrayim, the generation of Egypt, but he says, v'chein hu b'chol dor v'dor. In every single generation, in every historical epoch, b'sha'ash Yisrael v'akshin lihitariv biyotir, at the moment in which the Jewish people desire more than anything else to get rid of their differences and to become part of their dominant culture and the majority society, and the majority culture of their society, so at that point, as umot ha'olam mitrachkim mehem, so then the non-Jewish culture, the non-Jews around them, are going to distance themselves from them, umvachshim lechalot otam, and are going to desire to destroy them. Any time in every generation that the Jewish people desire that they want to be part of a civilization, to be part of a culture, that is going to be the point in which the non-Jews try to distance themselves from us.
So you're saying the more we're separate, the less anti-Semitism there is?
I think that To reframe that, I think what the Nativ is saying in conversation with the Iran that we just saw is that the non-Jewish resistance to Jewish assimilation is meant to keep us focused on our mission. It's supposed to keep us focused on our morality, our beliefs, our Torah. And the more that we try to distance ourselves from our identity, from our narrative, from our heritage, and we decide that we don't want to be Jews, we don't want to be servants of Hashem, so then at that point, that's when anti-Semitism emerges. I think that's what the Nativ is saying.
I mean, it's based off the Torah. I'm levadat yishkon. I mean, we're supposed to be not. So it's almost in a sense, almost an onesh type situation where here's your promise of am levadat yishkon. Granted, it's from Bilam, I get it, but that's a bracha. That's a bracha that's given to us. If we're going to toss that bracha away, well, then deal with the ramifications, which is you're going to get beaten. You're going to get beaten up.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And it's kind of like a reminder, and I'm not sure like how to take it, but it's a reminder to the Jews wherever they are that when anti-Semitism is happening around them, it's kind of a wake up call to say like, well, who are we as Jews? What is our identity? I want to continue with a quote from the anti-Semitism what is the word I'm looking for? Protest, unity, march that happened in New York last week. So we'll come back to that. But I think it's really interesting that this is the Nativ's approach, which is that anti-Semitism emerges when we're not on the right path and when we're not committed to our mission and our ideals and our values. Okay, so I want to turn a little bit more now to thinking about anti-Semitism, not necessarily theology, but more about definitions of anti-Semitism. So over the past few weeks, we've seen more violent anti-Semitism, and it's become more pronounced to us because it's so much more violent and dangerous. But something that
it's attracted from Jews, too.
And it's attracted from
Which
Jews.
Which is what we were saying, because we're not assimilating, we're actually sticking to it, and yet it's happening to us, too.
Yeah, that's kind of wondrous. And when it's of saying, like, yeah, this is supposed to happen when you're not religious, but now what's going on is it is religious people that are.
It's just, but in general, the Jews in America have assimilated in many ways, and the fact that these people are being targeted doesn't reflect that they're the ones specifically that they're working, right? They're just more identifiable.
Right.
It doesn't, yeah.
It's a more national, you're saying it's like a more national,
I think so.
Yeah, phenomenon.
I've heard this is the rationalization, not that I agree with this at all, of the Holocaust, and that because the German Jews were assimilated, the Polish Jews suffered.
Right.
Were killed, I mean, primarily.
So were the German Jews.
And so were the German Jews, right, yeah. I would say, but in the millions.
So they were affected by the Jews.
Right.
They
kept themselves more separate than
the Jews. Right. Yeah. I've heard that. It's like that fits his narrative.
Yeah, it definitely, it takes this narrative to a really strong degree, to more, I think, extreme position. I think that spurts of anti-Semitism probably are a little bit different than persecutions of pogroms. I do think it's interesting, though, that we see this Gemara about hatred, which is kind of the first millennium, and then we see kind of this, a little bit of a different position of the Nativ, which is, you know, we're talking about the modern age, and we've gone through the expulsions, and we've gone through persecutions, and Jews have really been through a lot of this time, and this is even pre-Holocaust, I think. So yeah, I'm not sure that the Nativ would say the same thing about the Holocaust. So something that I tried to do with my campers this past summer was I asked them, tell me what anti-Semitism is. How do you define anti-Semitism? Because if you don't know how to identify what anti-Semitism is, how can you call people out for being anti-Semitic and for having anti-Semitism occur in our midst? So we did a little exercise. I gave them a few minutes where we didn't have any definitions in front of us and tried to press them for it. I'm not going to do that with you guys now, but I wanted to present two different definitions of anti-Semitism, which I thought were have something to offer us, specifically in the period that we're in with the anti-Semitism that we're seeing. So the first definition comes from the European Forum on Anti-Semitism, where they have some sort of working definition of anti-Semitism in order to identify anti-Semitism in Europe. I will say that both of these definitions, I did not find them on my own. Deborah Lipstadt has a wonderful book on anti-Semitism that she just published last year. That's where I got these from. I'm not such a scholar. This first one is more of a policy definition. So the definition is, it's a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, toward Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. So we see a lot now of the physical manifestations of anti-Semitism. We see it toward property, toward shuls in particular. But what I think is interesting is that part of the definition is Jewish or non-Jewish. It's quite striking. How can anti-Semitism be against people who are not Jewish? Any ideas?
Pro-Semites? Victims?
Yes. What do you mean?
People who support Jews and encourage Jews and are defend Jews, or just as well be attacked as the Jews themselves.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I'm not sure that it's exactly what they're shooting for
in this.
It's
a weird definition.
Yeah, it is weird. So I have two examples I think are interesting. So one is on Twitter. There's this whole phenomenon I think 2 or 3 years ago that anti-Semites were figuring out and identifying who Jews were on social media, on Twitter, and they were using this sign, these parentheses, to indicate that these people were Jews so that they could launch hate speech and hate attack against these individuals. So what ended up happening is, by default, people who had Jewish-sounding last names, or people who perhaps were no longer Jewish because of intermarriage or assimilation, were getting attacked by these non-Jews, by these anti-Semites, because they had Jewish names. So what you end up happening is you have people who are not Jewish who become victims of anti-Semitism because these are perceptions of Jews which are expressions of hatred, even if they're not Jews. So I thought that was really interesting. And I think the second one, which is a little bit more extreme, was that in Nazi Germany, there were Jews who were no longer Jews, who were Christians. So for example, in the Warsaw Ghetto, there were churches, because the Nazis, by their definition of Jews, would bring even include non-Jews as people who were able to be put in ghettos and to be treated like Jews. So you had people who were completely assimilated, were no longer Jewish, practicing Christians, that were still subject to legal persecution and anti-Semitism. So I think that's incredibly interesting, because that's not something that really we see so often. So that's the first definition. The second definition comes from a sociology professor, which I think is really interesting. It's very academic. And I think there's really one point that I have here. So I'll read that definition. Anti-Semitism is a persisting latent structure of hostile beliefs towards Jews as a collectivity, manifested in individuals as attitudes, and in culture as myths, ideology, folklore, and imagery, and in actions, social or legal discrimination, political mobilization against Jews, and collective or state violence, which results in and or is designed to distance, displace, or destroy Jews as Jews. So this is incredibly loaded. But something that I want to hone in on here is the social or legal discrimination. We see this I think, emerging a lot more in Europe now, that they're creating, they're drafting legislation that targets Jewish rituals and practice. So I think the main one is Bris Milah, that they're trying to outlaw being able to do Bris Milahs in different European countries, because they think it's cruel and is a violation of human rights. And Shechita also, they're trying to get rid of Shechita because that goes against animal rights. A lot of rights here. And it's becoming really dangerous, especially you have, even in the state of California, they're starting to deal with some of these questions. There's a professor, I think, Michael Avi Halfand, who's a professor at Pepperdine University, who's been writing a lot about these rising issues of religion in state, where the First Amendment, which is supposed to protect our religious liberty, is there's increased there are more issues in which our First Amendment is being limited, our rights for religious freedom is being limited because of other concerns, and one of those rising concerns is Bris Milah, is circumcision, and we have to try to combat this legal and social discrimination, which prevents Jews from being Jews. So I kind of want to just hold on to that, two definitions of anti-Semitism. Okay. So the next page got cut off. So let's just look at the picture. This is from the No Hate, No Fear, a rally in New York, which I'm so sad that I missed, because it really was a great moment of solidarity in the Jewish community, of having really Jews of all backgrounds come together and really stand up against anti-Semitism. And so this is a picture of New York Times columnist Barry Weiss. I'm not sure if you are familiar with Barry Weiss. She is a Jewish columnist for the New York Times. She grew up pretty traditional in Pittsburgh. And after the Tree of Life shooting, she started becoming a lot more... She started to become a stronger advocate for the Jewish people and anti-Semitism and combating anti-Semitism, because she grew up in Pittsburgh going to that shul, and she did not like the way that the media was portraying the shooting and the way that it was portraying the Jewish people and anti-Semitism. So she actually wrote a book about anti-Semitism that I think was published at the end of last year. But they had her speak at this rally. So I highly recommend, if you have 5 minutes, to go watch her speech, because it's really... incredible. It's beautiful. It's passionate. It's inspiring. But I wanted to just bring a short selection from the speech, because I thought it was so powerful, but also that embedded in her speech is so many of these ideas and so many of these texts that we've kind of learned here together. So I think it's really something really special and unique. So here we go. I am a Jew because Jews are of every color and class and politics and language. And I am a Jew because hatred of us has no color or class or politics or language. I am a Jew because Jews do not cause Jew hatred, ever. Today, as in so many times in history, there are many forces in the world insisting that Jews must disappear or die. Some say it bluntly. Some cloak it in the language of progress. But I am a Jew because I know that there is a force far greater than that. And that is the force of who we are and the force of our world-changing ideas. The Jewish people were not put on earth to be anti-Semites. Such a powerful line. The Jewish people were not put on earth to be anti-Semites. Exactly what the Nitziv says. We have a greater mission. We have a greater journey ahead of us. We were put on earth to be Jews. We are the people whose God never slumbers or sleeps, lo yanum v'lo yishan, and so neither can we. We are the lamplighters. We are the ever-dying people that refuses to die. The people of Israel lives now and forever. Am Yisrael Chai. So powerful. That's so, that line of the Jewish people were not put on earth to be anti-Semites is so strong. It really resonates with me, because that's not what this is about. We have all these rallies and it's beautiful and unity, but it's about who we are as Jews. Anybody have any reflections, any thoughts? Any particular line that stands out in this?
Yeah, the comment of there are so many forces in the world insisting that Jews must disappear or die. Some say above me, some cloak in the language of progress. That's I've heard, and I read somewhere, I don't remember who wrote it, is the difference between Hanukkah and Purim. That Purim represents what we consider to nowadays right-wing anti-Semitism. You're different, I don't like you, it's going to kill you. That's why, you know, the right wing. The left wing is more the Hanukkah. You don't really need your Torah. Come on, let's progress. So you don't have this temple. It's all good. You don't really need it. That's kind of left represents more the left wing, and I think she captures it, both of them here, in essence.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say Hanukkah.
And
that
it's the same Alamesim for both.
Right. Yeah, that's a really great point. And Rabbi Sacks wrote a piece about how to understand American anti-Semitism, and he wrote, part of the speech was a Dvar Torah on Hanukkah, kind of making a very similar point about how Hanukkah is the holiday that we say no to that type of progressive desire for the Jews to give up our beliefs and our values. And so I kind of wanted to close with that, with this article Rabbi Sacks wrote, where he basically ends the article saying that there are three ways that we need to address anti-Semitism in our community. And I think Rabbi Sacks goes about this by first talking about how in England they've been working on anti-Semitism now for some time, because it's been a lot worse there, more particularly in Europe than just in the UK. But these are some steps that we can take toward addressing anti-Semitism. So the Rabbi Sacks writes, "The first priority must be to strengthen security in Jewish venues, to intensify police patrols, and develop habits of vigilance." So this is everywhere. This is every shul I see. Our shul is no different. All the shuls are stepping up security, and we're spending way more on security than we ever have in the past.
Self-defense.
And self-defense, really, to be more blunt about it. And that's really the first step. The second step, and I think this is strategically, but I think also spiritually, this really speaks to me. Next, we must recognize that while we have enemies, we also have friends, and they are many and strong. We need to make friends who will stand with us and help lead the fight. This is best done by explaining how anti-Semitism endangers everyone, because the hate that begins with the Jews never ends with the Jews. And this, when I read this line, I thought back immediately to the picture of Martin Luther King walking with Abraham Joshua Heschel in the civil rights protest, and thinking about how the Jews were always the ones who were progressive and helping underrepresented minorities, persecuted minorities, addressing these issues of persecution. And we were always there for them, and now it's kind of our time to go back to our friends and our allies and say, look, we need your help in this collaboration. It can't just be us. We all know, we've all been there in that situation of persecution and being minorities, and now we need to come together at a time that's more polarized than ever, with the rise of intersectionality, and you have to be my way, and if you're not my way, with all of the, you know, my oppression is worse than yours. We need to come together, and we need to say we're all partners here, because this hate is really coming from the same place. So really, this struck me not only as strategic, but as kind of, you know, the continuation of this relationship that the Jewish people has been fostering, especially in the United States, for so long. And lastly, we must never forget the message of Hanukkah. Fight back. Never be afraid. Whatever the threats, be proud to be Jewish and share this pride with others. That lastly, what it means to be Jewish is that we're proud to be Jews, and that we don't, when anti-Semitism comes, it doesn't mean that we need to go away and we need to hide, but we should be proud that we're Jews. We should be proud that this is our heritage, that this can be our role in the world, in our communities, in our families, with our children, with our friends, with our rabbis, and with our teachers. And kind of to close, you know, I think that this is really, you know, there are different views within Chazal about how we should, you know, view anti-Semitism. Is it just hatred? Is it because we're different? Is it because we do something? You know, is it because the non-Jews are jealous? But irrespective kind of that source, we should try to embrace the opportunity that we have and embrace our Jewish identities and double down on that. So thank you so much for coming out. Thank you so much for contributing and sharing, and I'm so happy that I got the opportunity to learn with you tonight. And really, thank you again for coming and for learning together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lots of food up here.